Hi, I'm Alexa. You can now hear PT Pinecast using me. Just say, hey Alexa, launch PT Pinecast. Or you could be nice and try saying please for once.
What is being polite dead these days?
To hear episodes, just say, hey Alexa, launch PT Pinecast. Maybe throw in a please at the end.
My mantra to the students are, they need to be the change in practice. They need to be that catalyst in the clinic. Don't just go into a clinic and do the things that the clinic is doing if there are things that you don't necessarily jive with. Be that change. Bring the new culture to clinicians who've been out there who may not know what is new in the research realm. So I really empower them to be that catalyst. And to be that change of the profession, taking it from the scholastic side of things, the academic side of things, into clinical practice.
Got a chance to talk to the Greenbergs, Eric and Elliot Greenberg, no relation. They had a couple of publications about ACL rehab and best practices. We have best practices, but are those best practices being put into practice? See what I did there? So they took a look at it from an orthopedic surgeon perspective, a physical therapist perspective, and really ultimately wanted to see why or why not those best practices were being actually utilized. So we took a talk with those two guys at the same time in this episode. Take a listen. I think it's got insights beyond just ACL rehab, right? Really insights into where's the fall off from best practice to actual practice. So we're going to get into that with these guys. Episode brought to you by Owens Recovery Science, a single source for PT. He's looking for certification in personalized blood flow restriction rehabilitation training and the equipment you need to apply it in your clinical practice. Zac Efron on social media, just seeing he's going through ACL rehab and using BFR. So that's kind of cool to see in the mainstream. And he did a little shout out to his great physical therapist and athletic trainers going through his rehab. So check it out, owensrecoveryscience.com, if you'd like to get certified and grab that equipment. We do want to let you know, we have another podcast that's been launched, PTE StudyCast, helping PT students study for the board exam. So check it out wherever podcasts are heard, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, NPTE StudyCast. It is brought to you by our friends at Aureus Medical Staffing. Without them, we wouldn't be able to bring it to you. We also have free downloadable study guides for each of the episodes, short to-the-point episodes between 3 and 9 minutes on average, about the 150 most asked about pathologies on the NPTE. So check that out. NPTE StudyCast, now available wherever podcasts are heard.
The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours.
Welcome aboard.
This is the PT Pinecast. Here's your host, physical therapist, Jimmy McKay.
The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Your next episode of PT Pinecast starts right now. Bringing in two Greenbergs. Do not get confused. They are not related. Elliot and Eric Greenberg, welcome to the show, guys.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Excellent. All right. So we'll start with Elliot. Elliot, what's your background? What should the audience know about you, about what you do in your daily life?
I have kind of a little bit of a split role. I work at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I'm about three quarters a clinician and about one quarter researcher here. Special interest in knee and shoulder injuries, particular ACLs, because it's what I see a lot of.
Glad to have you, Elliot. And Eric, what's your superhero backstory?
Superhero backstory. So right now I'm on Long Island and I'm a assistant professor in the Department of Physical Therapy at the New York Institute of Technology, where I teach in the curriculum there in the DPT program, but also treat the NYIT Division II athletes. And my current interests include working with, obviously, the athletic population with lower extremity injuries and running-related injuries.
Excellent. So how'd you guys meet anyway? I mean, I know, you know, Elliot, you're at CHOP in Philly. Eric, you're in New York. But how'd you guys cross paths? Were you at the same conference and picked up the other's name tag because you both have the same last name or what?
You know, it's kind of a long story, but Eric and I, we unknowingly, you know, kind of sort of crossed paths a long time in our lives together. But we did end up, we worked together at CHOP for a little while. And that's really how we really got to know each other and work together and kind of form a relationship.
So both of you guys have, you know, special interests in lower extremity injuries. Elliot working with pediatric and adolescent sports med, and Eric doing the same with some college athletes and being a a practicing PT as well. How did you guys decide to get together and do some research? And then we'll get into what it was and where the audience can find it.
So first off, I guess we both started on the research path together while we were together at CHOP. We did come out with a more of a retrospective analysis looking at the pediatric strength and functional return in the pediatric athlete. And then it kind of spurred into a little more while, and I remember it very closely when Elliot and I were standing next to each other at CSM. How long ago, Elliot, was it? Well, I remember when we were in that.
Yeah, it was in California, I think. Whenever it was in Anaheim,
yeah. Yeah, he looked at me and he had this idea that he's like, you know, we're coming out with all these recommendations, but we really don't know what it is that PTs are actually doing out there.
In terms of what? In terms of specifically ACL rehab, ACL return to play, return to sport, return to life?
Yeah, so when we were working together at CHOP, we would do a lot of these functional and strength testing on patients that we weren't really seeing. And when we were talking to them while they were coming in, we were getting the full gambit as far as what they were doing regarding their rehabilitation, along with what kind of criterion that their practicing PTs were using. So this got us to thinking about, you know, yes, there are recommendations and guidelines out there, but is there that much variability out there in clinical practice?
Gotcha. So you were seeing what all the research was, and that's what you're doing at CSM, but you're saying, well, what's actually being done? Where's the translation? What's the handoff from research and best practices to what's actually being done with athletes?
Yeah, I think it also kind of went in reverse too, because we had that kind of unique experience at CHOP where our surgeons kind of require their patients to come see their PTs to make sure they perform our functional testing program with ACL. You know, part of that is it's great because we get to interact with patients that we're not treating on a day-to-day basis. We're seeing them at 3 months post-op or 6 months post-op, and we're saying, all right, tell me what your PT is doing. And we get to hear from kind of the patient's perspective. Are they following kind of like what we would consider to be best practice guidelines? What have they done maybe prior to us coming in and the patients assessing us? And then we get to go to CSM and we hear what all this really great research is saying, and man, we should be doing more, we should be doing this. And it's like, but you know, the patients that we have coming in from outside our walls are maybe not even doing half of that too. So it's like, you know, it really spurred that idea of what's the general practitioner that's seeing, you know, maybe low back pain or older patients when they get kind of an ACL that walks in their door, you know, that they may not be a specialist in ACL. What is that person doing to make decisions about returning this person to play?
I like how it was formulated organically. You know, you guys standing there together at CSM and saying, hey, what about this? Why don't we take a look? But the cool part was you guys went and followed through and you wound up doing it. So talk about what happened next after that aha moment when you actually followed through.
We kind of formulated the idea and we brought together what we felt was a really good team of people with orthopedic surgeons that we work with here at CHOP and PTs. And we got the survey of what we wanted, the questions that we wanted to ask, kind of formulated that together. And then we thought, hey, this would be a great idea. Not only look at what physical therapists are doing, but on the other side, we should look at what orthopedic surgeons are doing as well. So we came up with this idea of this 360 degree scope of people that are involved in these rehab decisions, seeing what if kind of the thought pattern being the orthopedic surgeons are kind of the overall directors. They're the ones that are delivering the protocols for their patients and, you know, saying this is what should be done. You know, we should see what they think about practice patterns. And then PTs are the ones, you know, we're in the trenches. We're the ones that actually were applying these tests and what we feel should be best. You know, what do the PTs say? And we wanted to kind of see what both sides would say and then maybe be able to compare, contrast, and draw conclusions from them.
I like that. More like a timeline and being able to see, again, what's best practice. That's great. But what's actually being done on both ends in terms of the orthopedic surgeons and then the follow through with the physical therapists after the surgery. So how'd you guys approach it and what'd you guys find? Let's get into the nitty gritty.
Yeah, so one of the biggest things that we found was that there was a large variability, not just with the physical therapist, but also with the orthopedic surgeons. And I think it really probably underscores or underestimates the true variability out there, because the sample that we took from was the sports section, orthopedic section, and private practice section, or what's formerly known as those sections, I should say, with their new name changes. But it's a pretty, if you think about it, a homogeneous sample of people you would think that would be in the know of the current landscape of the literature. So it probably underscores or underestimates the true variability out there. Similarly, that we found even more variety in the orthopedic population, the surgeon population, and that was a sample of pediatric orthopedic surgeons from the Pediatric Research and Sports Medicine Group, PRISM Group. Once again, a very homogeneous sample that tends to be a little bit more up to date with their current recommendations. So we were quite surprised with the degree of variability that we found.
So I just want to stop you there to make sure I understand what you're saying and make sure the audience gets it too. So you're saying this group's pretty homogeneous. You figured it would they'd be more well informed because these are the people who go out of their way to not only be APTA members but to be section or academy members and seek out the research. So they should have been sticking to or at least be closer to the best practice guidelines that have been put forth so far. But you saw variability, which you're saying really highlights how much variability was out there that you couldn't even reach.
That's exactly it. Yep.
Okay. I just didn't want to make sure I want to make sure I understood that. So yeah, that is pretty telling. What were some of the results? You want to get into some of the highlights and some of the things that you guys found that maybe surprised you or didn't surprise you?
If you think about the decision-making process or the tools you're using from time-based parameters to some type of strength criteria to some type of functional performance measure to maybe some type of patient for outcome measure or psychological assessment or construct, right? I mean, the variation existed across all of those, but even in some of the more kind of what you would consider maybe more concrete things like time, we're not even agreeing on time of when to progress patients right now. And you think that there's probably the better, most amount of research looking to support like those simple, those type of concrete things, but we can't even agree. And then when you start drilling down into the details about, well, are we assessing strength? And everybody agreed like, yes, yeah, strength is important. But then when we asked, how are you assessing strength? And then variability just started from there, right? And some people, there was a large proportion of the sample of PTs that, you know, just relied on manual muscle testing to progress their patients. And kind of what the literature is showing us is that, you know, we're not going to be able to identify these higher levels of deficits that may exist for these patients when they're strong, but they're just not strong enough using manual muscle tests in isolation. But then when people that are using either maybe more objective measures like handheld dynamometry or if there's availability for isokinetic testing, the standards at which they're holding them to, the variability just continues to progress where some people required a 75% maybe limb symmetry index and some people were maybe above 100%. Like it's just, Eric and I were surprised that as we drilled down, you know, in the details of what we're doing in everyday practice, we can agree on broad strokes. We can agree that strength is important. But man, when you start like measuring strength, like how you're actually applying it and doing it, that's really different for everybody, I think.
Yeah, you're saying the framework is there, but how you actually apply and actually measure things like time or strength, which everyone, you know, pretty much agrees on being important factors to take into consideration. When you start looking at even smaller there, that's where you see even more of the variability come into play.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eric, what do you want to add?
More like the devil's in the details a little bit. It's like you talk to clinicians and nobody's going to argue that strength, that knee strength is not going to be important. But I think once you start to hammer down onto how are they testing or assessing the strength of their patient, are you really comparing apples to apples when you start to go across different clinics, clinicians, and patients? And I think it really does create a little bit confusion, not just in the PT population, in the clinician population, but also when patients start to talk to one another, when they're like, oh yeah, I've been cleared. How'd they test your, or how, they hooked me up to this machine four times and I have to get at least 90%. And the other person's like, oh, I've never done that before. And, right. And they're back on the field playing already. I think it really does create a little bit of confusion within the society as well as are we really treating the same patients across different clinicians and clinics and practitioners
in the same profession, you know, right? And that's a great example of when you get two patients together and they say, oh, we have the same injury, so we must have done the same type of rehab or at least hit these big benchmarks. And when they're different, that's confusing. And again, I get it, patients are different from patient to patient. But if this is what best practices are, how come there's so much variability? Were you able to hone in and either measure and ask, or at least if not speculate, why is it, you know, why do we take it upon ourselves to have so much variability?
I think within the PT arm of the survey that we studied, we were able to get some of those details. We tried to look at clinician factors that maybe influenced some of their decisions that they use. So we had, we kind of broke people down into either high volume or low volume practitioners, where we said anybody that treated more than 10 ACLs per year, we accounted for them as high volume practitioners, and those less than that were low volume. We looked at certified specialists versus not certified specialists, and we looked at years of clinical experience. And, you know, if we don't know what the best program is, or, you know, like we like you said a few times, we have our current, you know, best standards that we have, or our practice standards, but we don't know if those are ideal, and those will hopefully change as we continue to learn more. But if we looked at the characteristics of the clinicians relative to the decision they were making, it seemed like certified specialists were more likely to follow, either orthopedic or sports certified specialists were more likely to follow those kind of current best practice guidelines. And also those clinicians that were into our kind of high volume clinicians seemed to kind of follow more of those best practice standards. So to our best guess is kind of what we've seen within our results is that maybe those clinicians are maybe more tied into the current literature, or maybe buy into the current literature more and maybe see the investment in their practice.
Yeah, they're going out of the way. That's a self-selected group, which we started talking about at the top of the show. These are people who say, when you're an SCS or when you're seeing high volume, I better be doing the best, because I'm, you know, practices wise, because I'm seeing so many of these types of patients, these specific type of patients, each and every year. Variability in terms of testing, I can imagine sometimes would have to do with availability of equipment, right? Each practice setting is going to be different.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that came about up in some of our speculation, is that people that tend to see high volume ACLs probably see the investment in an isokinetic dynamometer, or even like a handheld dynamometer, versus someone who's maybe in a facility where they're not seeing as many of those types of patients may not be willing to invest in something because there's no cost benefit for them or return on their investment in the long term. And obviously there are other financial issues that you could come across, space issues potentially. So I think there's a lot of confounding issues that could arise that can reason why someone is not using this type of instrumentation.
Where can the audience find this and download and kind of consume it themselves? Want to make sure they get access to it.
Yeah, so the PT survey was published in JOSPT in October issue of 2018, and the orthopedic surgeon arm of the study was just published last month in the Orthopedic Journal of Sports Medicine. So you can go to OJSM and you can download. That's a free full text there, so you can download full text there, no problem.
What was some of the attitudes of people who participated in this after the results were revealed? Were they shocked? Were they surprised? Were they you know, pledging to change their practice because they saw such variability? Or did anything come out of that?
I don't think it was that surprising. I think the survey kind of showed what everybody kind of already thought existed or knew existed, that there's this variation out there, and everybody's like, wow, I knew it was variable, but I didn't think it was that variable. You know, I think that was kind of like, it just reinforced some of the thoughts. We did get a couple of follow-up emails from people like saying, hey, this is really nice. I enjoyed reading this. It was kind of good study, but I don't know, Eric, any different opinion with that?
No, you know what it was interesting. I think it got a lot of publicity on some social media platforms, almost like a shock value of, we need to do better. You know, by no means do I think, do our return to play testing, is it bulletproof? Is it the best thing out there? Is it catching all people who may be at risk? But at least it's the best we have at this point. But it seems as if people aren't even doing that at this point. So how could we really say that it's not doing what it claims to be doing if people out there aren't really doing it? So I think it really gained some headway on these social media platforms of saying, hey guys, let's do a little bit better out there.
I like that. Gonna take a quick break. Want to thank our sponsors, Aureus Medical Staffing, for keeping the show on the air. They find PTs jobs, whether you're going to do Philadelphia or Long Island or anywhere. You want to do a beach, a lake, you want to go mountains, you want to ski, you can do that. That's the cool part of variability in our profession is people need PT all over. So go do what you want where you want to do it, and Arius gets you set up. AURUSmedical.com. Not only just having the positions, but as well as being able to walk you through all the pain points. What do I do if I'm licensed in New York, but I want to go work in California for a couple of months? They've got people on board to help you walk you through that so you're not on your own. Housing, how do you find where to live? And does the person that is hiring you, do they pay for that? They've got someone to walk you through that as well. The thing that freaked me out the most was taxes. If you live in New York, but you're temporarily working in Colorado, what do you do? Again, Arius has someone for that as well. So check them out if you want to do a short-term placement or looking to relocate long-term. AURUSmedical.com. Where would you guys go if you could go anywhere in the 50 U.S. states? If you were to do exactly what you want to do, what state haven't you been to that you would give a shot for 13 weeks?
What state haven't I been to? Well, I was thinking more of a state that I have been to. I'm a Florida Gator. We go down to Pensacola Beach, Florida every year for a week. And that is one of my favorite places in the United States. But for a place I haven't been to, had you not picked Hawaii, I have not been there.
I think I would probably pick somewhere in the mountains, like you were saying. I go Pacific Northwest.
Well, that's the cool part. Anywhere in the 50 U.S. states, check them out, AURUSmedical.com.
Stand by. Stay tuned. We'll be right back to the PT Pinecast.
If you're looking for education past your physical therapy degree, look no further than Brooks IHL. That's Brooks Rehabilitation Institute of Higher Learning. You can find out more at brooksihl.org. Continuing education, along with residencies and fellowships. Residencies in orthopedics, geriatrics, women's health, neurologic PT, pediatrics, sports, and a fellowship opportunity as well. So look into it if you're looking to expand your knowledge base. BrooksIHL.org.
Back to the PT Pinecast with Jimmy McKay.
Question, how are the views, or how was the reaction? You guys mentioned some kind of shock value on PT social media saying, hey, you know, kind of almost a rallying cry. Maybe we need to do better. Let's do better. Was there any reaction from the orthopedic surgeons, since they're the kind of the first touch point in the patient, and then they pass them off to us? I bet you they expect us to be doing best practices. What was their reaction to the results?
I haven't seen much reaction, to be honest with you. The result, you know, there's a lot more talk about it, and that's probably just the circles that Eric and I kind of fly in within the PT realm. When we did present this at conference, we got a lot of really good feedback. We actually won the best paper award at the PRISM conference the year we did present this at that conference. So I think there was a lot of kind of good value in the paper and the topics. And, you know, we're hoping that maybe it's going to help drive some change on the orthopedic side and change things around too. So
ultimately, I guess the question I need to ask is, how do we do better? You know, we have these academies now, we specialize, we have best practices. Is there anything that you would, if you could make wave a magic wand that you would put into play, how can we do better?
I did a residency at the University of Delaware. I did a sports residency there under the guidance of Lynn Steiner-Mackler, who's been a huge advocate for the just test. You know, you need to test these folks. And there's been research out there that say that you don't need an isokinetic dynamometer to assess quad strength. All you need is a knee extension machine that every clinic was throwing out a few years back, and now they're starting to get them out of the trash. So I think it comes down to, you know what, take the time out. It's worth your while for the information that you get just to do repetition maximum testing if that's all you have. If you have a handheld dynamometer, use those types of testing. But I think it's taking the time out and maybe sacrificing other parts of your treatment to really get the data that you need to make educated decisions.
Yeah, and that's a valuable thing, right? Giving up some time. But if what you're presenting is correct, which we would assume it would be, since it's best practices, that time is well spent. What were you going to say? Sorry, I didn't want to cut you off.
Yeah, sorry. I agree. I think engaging this conversation is actually helpful, and getting some of that social media. I know on your show you've talked about kind of the lag time between evidence to trickle down into everyday practice, and I think the social media conversation is really helpful. So I think it pushes that to people that probably wouldn't have, you know, picked up the paper or read it beforehand. And there's so much stuff about ACL coming out. I mean hundreds of papers every year to try and digest all that. But I think trying to just at least maybe help reinforce some of this, you know, the current standards that we think are the best, to try to help you know, get that out to general practitioners that don't specialize in ACLs, but probably see the majority of ACL patients because they make up, you know, the majority of the general practices that are out there,
right.
And maybe helping to adopt some of these guidelines that are being put forth.
Well, look, I like to look at the positive. At least there are best practices, right? And we're pushing our profession towards finding out what is best. That's great. That's a great problem to have. Is how do we now disseminate that and make sure it gets put into play? At least we got that first part. At least we're really, really paying attention to the first part. Now, if we, as you just mentioned, continue to have those conversations, maybe, hopefully, it'll help that second part with dissemination.
Yeah.
Last thing I wanted to ask, Eric, you've got a unique situation in terms of working with students. Any strategies to encourage students and new clinicians to adopting best practices and making the change in current practice patterns to hopefully, as they progress in their careers, continue that and then teach other students to change the profession?
Yeah, you know, I as an instructor and a professor at this point, I tend to utilize a lot of social media and podcasts, some of your own actually, and other types of blogs and things like that after I screen through them with my students, because I feel like it's very powerful to hear it from the sources. It's also more digestible for them than reading the textbooks or hearing me talk about it up there. So I utilize that, and it empowers them to get engaged in conversation with the people who are actually putting out this literature and the people who do have the experience aside from just hearing it from myself as the sage on the stage. I also, my mantra to the students are, you know, they need to be the change in practice. They need to be that catalyst in the clinic. Don't just go into a clinic and do the things that the clinic is doing if there are things that you don't necessarily jive with. Be that change. Bring the new culture to clinicians who've been out there who may not know what is new in the research realm. So I really empower them to be that catalyst and to be that change of the profession, taking it from the scholastic side of things, the academic side of things, into clinical practice.
Love it. Be the change. Right? It's not going to change unless you take take what you learn in school or in your clinical rotations and actually start to do it. I love that. Last part of the show is the parting shot.
This is the parting shot.
The parting shot is brought to you by Rock Tape. More than just a tape company, Rock Tape is a movement company, tools and education for medical professionals. If you're looking to help your patients go stronger longer, check out rocktape.com. You guys have an opportunity to leave one sentiment with the audience before you go. Who wants to go first with their parting shot?
Eric, I'll let you kick it off. How about that?
All right. So I guess my parting shot would probably be, I think the best thing that we could do with dealing with our patients is connect with them. Understand that they're not an ACL tear. They're a person who had an ACL tear. And in dealing with kids and dealing with adults, you know, you need to manage each person differently by using the best evidence as your guide, but understanding that you need to tailor that intervention to the person. And if you could just connect with that person, you're going to make that person better regardless of what you do, as long as you're letting evidence guide you.
Love it. Elliot, you're up, man. Parting shot, what do you got?
I think just making sure you continue to grow as a clinician. You know, I think seeing a lot of ACL patients and unfortunately seeing a lot of them fail or have re-injury or secondary injury has driven me to want to get better, you know? And I think just kind of continuing to grow as a clinician and use those events and that learning to better yourself for the next person around is an important thing.
Love that. Before we go, Eric, I'm just, you're prescribing podcast episodes as homework or as outside learning to students. I love to hear that.
I am. I get made fun of by my other faculty members because of it. But obviously, I listen to a lot of them like beforehand. I don't just give it to them. But I feel like it's a lot more digestible for them. They can do it while they're driving into school. They can do it while they're working out. So they can work it into their everyday life. And it also brings them, they stumble upon other things within that podcast. And it's more student-directed learning after that because they're like, oh, I listened to this on this certain podcast. And then I saw another episode that I listened to and it really interests me. So it starts to get them on that self-directed learning, which is so important. Important for when they do graduate is how do they, you know, now the information's not coming to them. They have to go out and seek it. So
it teaches them that new skill.
You know, selfishly, I love to hear that, obviously, because I host a couple different podcasts, but I like it because as the guy with a degree in communications, you're talking or you're trying to facilitate a conversation the way your audience listens, and you're listening the way your audience talks. And that's a way to facilitate great conversation instead of what you mentioned earlier, being the sage on the stage. That's a presentation, right? Some people do learn really well from presentation. Myself, I'm a conversation guy, obviously. So, you know, selfishly, hey, yeah, love to hear that you're prescribing, assigning podcast episodes, maybe one or two from my show, to students. But just love the fact that you're open to it. And I do want to highlight, you mentioned it twice, that you do screen through that. Anybody with a microphone can create a podcast, super easy, but I love the fact that you're screening it and highlighting, hey, pay attention to this. And they do, after that, if they trip across an episode that, you know, it, you know, hasn't been screened, they need to take that upon themselves, because there's a lot of information and, you know, less than great information out there too.
Absolutely. I think that's the most important thing, is that you're really screening through it to make sure, because there's a lot of stuff out there that maybe you doesn't really jive with the intentions of what you want them to get to learn.
And last point I'll make is, I love that too, because once they graduate, they don't have a professor down the hall, or they aren't running into someone each and every week, or having that information brought to them. They need to start to seek it out. And I think, handing over an idea of a blog to read or a podcast to listen to or a video channel to follow, that's a great digestible way, as we mentioned before, of getting information once you start working 40 hours a week when you graduate. Gentlemen, want to say thanks very much for your time. Don't think it'll be the last when we have you guys on the show, but excited to share this episode with everybody.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. Thanks for having us on.
The PT Pinecast is a product of PT Pinecast LLC. It is hosted and produced by PT Pinecast CEO Jim McKay and CBO Sky Donovan from Marymount University. We talk PT, drink beer, and record it. This has been another pour from the PT Pinecast. The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. More on the show at ptpinecast.com.
Our home on the internet. ptpinecast.com. Created by Build PT. Build PT provides marketing services specifically for private practice PTs.
From website development and hosting,
providing content marketing solutions
for PT clinics across the country.
See what Build PT can do for you today
at buildpt.com.
The PT Pinecast proudly supports the Travis Mills Foundation. On April 10th, 2012, United States Army Staff Sergeant Travis Mills of the 82nd Airborne was critically injured on his third tour of duty in Afghanistan by an IED while on patrol, losing portions of both legs and both arms. He is one of only five quadruple amputees from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to survive his injuries. Thanks to his amazing strength, courage, and incredible will to live, the heroic actions of the man in his unit, the prayers of thousands, and all the healthcare providers at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, Travis remains on the road to recovery. He founded the Travis Mills Foundation, a nonprofit organization formed to benefit and assist combat injured veterans. Travis lives by his motto, never give up, never quit. To support the Travis Mills Foundation or to find out more, visit travismills.org.